everyone. It's Naomi Wolf, and I'm here with Geneva Bible 15. This is kind of an experiment because I've never done it this way before. So please tell me in the comments if you can see and hear me, because I'm on the move and I'm trying to do multiple platforms at once. But if this is working, let me know. And I'm just going to go ahead and start reading and hope for the best, because we don't want to miss a day, if we can help it, of the Geneva Bible. And of course, those of you who are following along know that we are at Exodus chapter 15 of the 1560 Geneva Bible, the Founders Bible, the Puritans Bible, the Bible that preceded the Shakespeare's Bible, the Bible that preceded the King James Version, translated directly from the Hebrew by dissidents, some of whom were martyred for the heresy of making the Bible understandable to, as they put it, the plowman in the field. Then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord, and said, in this manner, I will sing unto the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and him that rode upon him hath he overthrown in the sea. The Lord is my strength and my praise, and he is become my salvation. He is my God, and I will prepare him a tabernacle. He is my father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. His name is Jehovah. Pharaoh's chariots and his host have he cast into the sea. His chosen captains also were drowned in the Red Sea. The depths have covered them. They sank to the bottom as a stone. Thy right hand, O Lord, is glorious in power. Thy right hand, O Lord, hath bruised the enemy. And by the way, just jumping in, remember that echo, what else was bruised? In the Garden of Eden, the heel of Eve was bruising the serpent, and vice versa. And in thy great glory, thou hast overthrown them that rose against thee. Thou sent'st forth thy wrath, which consumed them as the stubble. And by the blast of thy nostrils, the waters were gathered. The floods stood as an heap. The depths congealed together in the heart of the sea. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will overtake them. I will divide the spoil, the treasure. My lust shall be satisfied upon them. I will draw my sword. Mine hand shall destroy them. Thou blewest with thy wind. You blew with your wind. The sea covered them. They sank as lead in the mighty waters. Who is like unto thee, O Lord, among the gods? Who is like unto thee, so glorious in holiness, fearful in praises, doing wonders? You stretched out your right hand, the earth swallowed them. You will, by your mercy, carry this people which you delivered. You will bring them in your strength unto your holy habitation. The people shall hear and be afraid. Sorrow shall come upon the inhabitants of Palestina. Then the dukes of Edom shall be amazed, and trembling shall come upon the great men of Moab. All the inhabitants of Canaan shall wax faint-hearted. Fear and dread shall fall upon them. Because of the greatness of your arm, they shall be still as a stone till your people pass, O Lord, till this people pass, which you have purchased. And as you recall, because I see that we read the same passage yesterday, or in the last video, purchase means redeemed. It's the same as purchasing a slave and giving a slave liberty, redemption. You shall bring them in and plant them in the mountain of your inheritance, which is the place that you have prepared, O Lord, for to dwell in, even the sanctuary, O Lord, which your hands shall establish. The Lord shall reign forever and ever. For Pharaoh's horses went with his chariots and horsemen into the sea, and the Lord brought the waters of the sea upon them. But the children of Israel went on dry land in the midst of the sea. And Miriam, the prophetess, sister of Aaron, took a timbrel in her hand, and all the women came out after her with timbrels and dances. And Miriam answered the men, sing ye unto the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider has he overthrown in the sea. Then Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur. And they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no waters. And when they came to Marah, they could not drink of the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. And you remember that Marah means bitter. Therefore, the name of the place was called Marah. Then the people murmured against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And he cried unto the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree, which when he had cast into the waters were sweet. There he made them an ordinance and a law, and there he proved them, meaning tested them, and said, "If you will diligently hearken, O Lord, unto the voice of the Lord your God, and will do that which is right in his sight, and will give ear unto his commandments, and keep all his ordinances, then will I put none of these diseases upon you, which I brought upon the Egyptians, for I am the Lord that heals you." And they came to Elim, where were 12 fountains of water and 70 palm trees, and they camped there by the waters. So it looks like we've got listeners. I got a thumbs up. I'm going to go back to the next chapter, chapter 16. Afterward, all the congregation of the children of Israel departed from Elim. And remember, Elim means heights, and it also means gods, and came to the wilderness of Sin, which is between Elim and Sinai. And that's Mount Sinai, of course, the 15th day of the second month after their departing out of the land of Egypt. And the whole congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron in the wilderness. For the children of Israel said to them, "Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the flesh pots, when we ate bread, our bellies full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole company with famine." Then said the Lord unto Moses, "Behold, I will cause bread to rain from heaven to you, and the people shall go out and gather that that is sufficient for every day, that I may prove them whether they will walk in my law or no." And remember, prove them in this context means test them, like proof, like proof of something, like almost a scientific test. Can they manage it? Can they handle it? Will they walk in my law or no? "But the sixth day they shall prepare that which they shall bring home, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily." Then Moses and Aaron said unto all the children of Israel, at evening, you shall know that the Lord brought you out of the land of Egypt. And in the morning you shall see the glory of the Lord, for he hath heard your grudgings against the Lord. And what are we that you have murmured against us? Again, Moses said, "At even shall the Lord give you flesh to eat, and in the morning your fill of bread. For the Lord has heard your murmurings, which you murmur against him. For what are we? Your murmurings are not against us, but against the Lord." And Moses said to Aaron, "Say unto all the congregation of the children of Israel, draw near before the Lord, for he has heard your murmurings." Now, as Aaron spoke unto the whole congregation of the children of Israel, they looked toward the wilderness. And behold, the glory of the Lord appeared in a cloud. For the Lord had spoken unto Moses, saying, "I have heard the murmurings of the children of Israel. Tell them therefore, and say, at evening, you shall eat flesh," meaning meat, "and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God." So at even, the quails came and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay round about the host, meaning the encampment, the army almost, the assembled people. And when the dew that was fallen and ascended, behold, a small round thing was upon the face of the wilderness, small as the hoarfrost on the earth. And when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, "It is mun," for they wist not, they knew not what it was. And Moses said unto them, "This is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is the thing which the Lord has commanded. Gather of it every man according to his eating an omer," which is a measurement, "for a man according to the number of your persons," meaning the number of people in your household, in your family. "Every man shall take for them which are in his tent." And the children of Israel did so and gathered, some more, some less. And when they did measure it with an omer, he that had gathered much had nothing over, and he that had gathered little had no lack. So every man gathered according to his eating. And I'll just break in there and say, what does that remind you of? Of course, this is foreshadowing the other miracles of abundance, like the dividing of the bread and fishes by Jesus in the New Testament, where everyone's basket was full and there were leftovers and everyone had enough. Moses then said unto them, let no man reserve thereof till morning. Notwithstanding, though they obeyed not Moses, but some of them reserved of it till morning, and it was full of worms and stank. Therefore Moses was angry with them. And they gathered it every morning, every man according to his eating. For when the heat of the sun came, it was melted. And the sixth day they gathered twice so much bread, two omers for one man. Then all the rulers of the congregation came and told Moses. And he answered them, this is that which the Lord has said. Tomorrow is the rest of the holy Sabbath unto the Lord. Bake that today which ye will bake, and seethe that which ye will seethe, meaning cook or simmer. And all that remains, lay it up to be kept till the morning for you. And they laid it up till morning, and as Moses bade, as he directed, and it stank not, neither was there any worm therein. Then Moses said, eat that today, for today is the Sabbath unto the Lord. Today ye shall not find it in the field. 6 days shall ye gather it, but in the seventh day is the Sabbath. In it there shall be none. Notwithstanding, there went out some of the people in the seventh day for to gather, and they found none. And the Lord said unto Moses, how long refuse you to keep my commandments and my laws? Behold how the Lord has given you the Sabbath. Therefore he gives you the sixth day bread for 2 days. Tarry therefore every man in his place, meaning tarry means wait or be still. Let no man go out of his place the seventh day. So the people rested the seventh day, and the house of Israel called the name of it Man. And it was like to coriander seed, but white, and the taste of it was like unto wafers made with honey. And Moses said, this is that which the Lord has commanded, fill an omer of it to keep it for your posterity, your children, your descendants, that they may see the bread wherewith I have fed you in the wilderness when I brought you out of the land of Egypt. Moses also said to Aaron, take a pot and put an omer full of man therein and set it before the Lord to be kept for your posterity. As the Lord commanded Moses, so Aaron laid it up before the testimony to be kept. And the children of Israel did eat man 40 years until they came unto a land inhabited. They did eat man until they came to the borders of the land of Canaan. The omer is the 10th part of the ephah, and that is a unit of measurement. So let's see if this is working. All right, that is the end of chapter 16, 15 and 16. Hey everyone, it's Dr. Naomi Wolf. I want to extend my heartfelt thanks to our valued partners at The Wellness Company. It's a time now when uncertainty is lurking everywhere. Preparedness is no longer an option at the margins. It's 100% necessary. And that's where The Wellness Company's medical emergency kit comes in. The Wellness Company's medical emergency kit contains crucial medications such as ivermectin, emergency antibiotics such as amoxicillin, antivirals, Z-Pak. The kit is backed by the expertise of the Wellness Company and their team of renowned medical professionals, including Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. James Thorpe, Dr. Harvey Risch, Dr. Drew Pinsky, and other truth-seeking, truth-telling doctors. They have created a kit that sets the gold standard for safety and prevention, the ultimate preparedness solution. Don't wait for a medical crisis to catch you or your family off guard. Visit DailyCloutHealth.com and use promo code DailyClout for an exclusive 10% discount. Take charge of your preparedness and enjoy peace of mind. And please do support our wonderful sponsors, The Wellness Company.
I will go ahead and wrap up the analysis just so that we are not losing our momentum on what is this very important day today, which is the last day before Passover, Pesach. And let's see, is there anything else I can do to restore the video? Let me know if you can see me. Okay, you can see me again. My apologies. That's probably my lack of technical expertise because I'm trying to read and broadcast at the same time on the same device, which I will not do again. So let's just talk about what we have experienced together. You heard again the celebration of the children of Israel, of Miriam, the sister of Aaron and Moses, this incredible family, really, that we're all aligned in trying to bring a whole new practice to these children of Israel who are, remember, they're not yet Jews. They're just a tribe. They're a few of their ancestors had this, you know, very unusual relationship to this God, Yahweh, and they respected Joseph, they respected Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, but they don't yet have a religion. I mean, that's very important to keep that in mind. We haven't yet had, you know, the tabernacle. We haven't yet had the priests. We haven't yet had the Ten Commandments. I mean, those are still ahead. All we have is this desert tribe who keeps being kind of, you know, bothered by God, right? It, you know, with the patriarchs of this tribe being kind of stopped in their tracks with a burning bush or with messages or with angels showing up. And God keeps trying to get their attention and keeps giving them instructions. Basically, this is how you become my people. This is how you follow me. So something really big has happened, as you recall, after the, you know, harrowing, miserable 10 plagues that have afflicted the children of Egypt and their leader who keeps not listening to God's will, even though God keeps trying to, you know, get Pharaoh's attention. We talked about that in the last reading. In spite of all of that, it didn't work. The children of Egypt could not, you know, weren't saved in their relationship with Yahweh because, you know, primarily because of bad leadership. And so the children of Israel have fled. You remember that the angel of God has told the children of Israel to mark their lintels. This is very important. This is going to be on my Seder plate tonight at the Seder I'm going to. To this day, there's going to be a lamb shank, is one of the symbols I'm going to see on the Passover platter that has these various symbolic objects. It's very, I don't want to say it's very primal, almost, what's going to happen tonight. It descends 2,000 years ago, what I'm going to sit down in Beverly, Massachusetts at a Chabad service. And I'm going to, you know, cover my head because I'm a married woman and it's an Orthodox Seder. So out of respect for that tradition, I'm going to be, you know, modestly dressed, covered my arms. I'm going to cover my arms, cover my legs, cover my hair. And I'm going to sit down and join other people who are celebrating, Jews and non-Jews, by the way. The Chabad community welcomes everybody. And on this platter, for those of you who've never been to a Passover Seder, there's going to be a lamb shank. And it's very interesting how you prepare the lamb shank. You literally take a lamb bone from your butcher and you burn it a little bit at the fire. And I remember as a child being fascinated by this, like literally on the gas flame of your stove. It may be that Orthodox Jews have a different method, but this is how my conservative family did it, which is less observant kind of being Jewish than Orthodox Jews. And so that's why we have a lamb shank. Well, partly to remember this, that God told the children of Israel, you know, put a mark your lintels, mark your doors with the blood of a lamb, and that way will spare your firstborn. And because all those firstborn kids, sons, thousands of years ago were spared, you know, we have this sense tonight of a direct descent from this event in history. And we're supposed to remember it. And in a chapter or two, you'll hear God saying to us, you're supposed to remember this, these miracles that I did for you. And in the Passover Seder, we're also given a little booklet that is the kind of service for tonight. And really the centerpiece of the service is retelling this story so that, especially for the kids, so the children of Jews, and again, you're supposed to invite non-Jews as well, everybody's welcome, right? Remember that, you know, what God did for us. And yes, it is, you know, specifically in the story, this tribe of desert nomads, you know, shepherds and slaves wandering around in, at this point, the wilderness of Tzin, which is, I think, in the Sinai is what we call it today. But it's really for all of us. You know, this is kind of, God keeps trying to create this model relationship. I keep saying that, right? In which, and you can, it's so funny that in the original or in the Geneva Bible, you keep getting this sense of God as this exasperated parent of teenagers who just will not follow his very reasonable requests and directions. It's like, you know, okay, let me teach you how to drive a car. Here are the keys, turn on the gas, you know, no, don't speed, right? Please obey the traffic signals. So this is what, in this exchange, right? He's like, the children of Israel have been saved by literally the Red Sea parting. This was Exodus 14. They're walking through the Red Sea. It's a wall on either side of them. God is literally parting the waters so that they can get through safely. They get through to the other side. The Red Sea closes over the armies of Pharaoh. All their pursuers that were going to rape and pillage and enslave them and kill them are no more. They're under the water. And that their relief and appreciation lasts for about a minute and a half, right? And within like moments of being in the wilderness, understandably, there, you know, I've been to the Sinai, it's pretty barren. There's not a lot to eat if you don't know where to look. And it could be really scary. So, but they don't trust God. They keep not trusting God. Granted, it would have been hard to have complete trust with no anxiety in the middle of the desert, especially because these were people who, this is to me the center of this passage, these last couple of chapters, all they knew is slavery, this generation. All they knew was slavery. So important for us now to think about that in a time when, you know, the equivalent of Pharaoh is trying to enslave us, right? Everywhere we look, people are trying to enslave us. Well, why resist that? It's not just for our sake as this generation. It's also for our kids' sake. And let me know if the video is coming through for you guys. Because, you know, here we have a generation of people born and raised in captivity. All they know is slavery. They don't know how to set out. They've lost the skills of setting out as masters of their own fate, or even making decisions as impactful as trusting God, right, in a dangerous situation. They have a slave mentality. So immediately, thank you, Mark McLeod says you're live, or Stu Williams says you're live, Mark McLeod says all good. Thanks so much, everyone. So what do? I mean, understandably, but also regrettably, they immediately start to complain to Moses. And they say, and they're very whiny. I mean, I'm the first to say, you know, they are super whiny. And what they literally say is like, why didn't you kill us in Egypt? Because there we sat by the flesh pots of Egypt. And, you know, remember that expression. That expression is so beautiful and evocative. It's gone into English literature, English poetry, the flesh pots of Egypt. And what that means is, literally, it means pots of flesh, right? Meaning, and flesh is basar, which is meat, which is flesh, right? It's the same word. So it's a little less exotic than flesh pots, you know, but it's literally pots of meat. We were enslaved, but we had lots of good food, is basically what they're saying. Why did you bring us to the desert where we're free, but we're going to starve to death? But the flesh pots of Egypt also represents a, like, metaphorically, we have the choice to sit by the flesh pots of Egypt, right? In our daily lives. I mean, people who in the last few years chose to keep their cushy jobs rather than tell their fellow men and women what they knew, if they knew that, say, a an injection could kill or murder them or disable them or sterilize them, they sat by the flesh pots of Egypt, right? They stayed in a state of slavery to an idea, right? Or to dark forces, I would say. But they were comfortable materially. So to me, the flesh pots of Egypt, and this is how this is descended in English poetry, they're literal, but they're also metaphorical, right? It's staying in a comfortable situation that may be prosperous materially, but where you're totally not in alignment with free will or God's will or higher consciousness or service to your fellow human being. You're in a compromised situation where you may not be literally a slave, you know, building bricks for Pharaoh, but you're enslaved, right? Because these people who took this money, right, to toe the line, to stick to a script, they're enslaved. They're enslaved to an ideology. They're enslaved to a script. They're enslaved to a group consensus. They're not free. And they're not free to follow God, for sure. So to me, that's the secondary meaning of the flesh pots of Egypt. And then they go on to have this incredible miracle, you know, one of many incredible miracles, which is they're saying to Moses, like, we're hungry. So Moses says, and you could hear like three times, God says to Moses, okay, I'm going to feed them. And it's going to look like this. They'll get this food at night. They'll get this food at night and this food in the morning. And they shouldn't take more than they can eat in a day. And then it takes three times for him to repeat himself because they're just not believing him. They're still whining. They're still complaining. But it really happens. There's this material, which has been translated as manna, falls from heaven. It comes as dew. And then in the morning, it's bread. It's edible. And it's like caraway seeds, but white. Very specific. And sometimes you get, again, as a literary scholar, I'm not a theologian, sometimes you get these details. They're like caraway seeds, but white. And the specificity of that really makes you think, all right, maybe it was something else, you know, that appeared, some mysterious grass or herb that grew in the desert suddenly overnight. Maybe it had a natural origin that was explainable. They just didn't understand. They confused it with the dew. They attributed it to God, but it really happened. Something really happened, right? That if you're just going to make something up out of thin air, I don't think you'd get this incredible, like, not even very inspiring detail. You know, it's like caraway seeds, but white. That really sounds like oral history passed down and passed down and passed down from some real event, in the Sinai Desert, thousands of years ago, something was there and they ate it and it sustained them. Well, so this kept happening, but even though God was super specific, they can take enough for their families, but don't take more than they can eat in a day, they kept disregarding him and they would take more because, you know, it's understandable. Okay, this miraculous thing happened today, but I've still got hungry kids. I better, you know, take extra so there will be enough for tomorrow. But the whole point of this back and forth is God is trying to say to these people, trust me, trust me. It's not like, this is another one of those moments where I think this has been so badly miscommunicated to people. It's not obey me the way I read it. It's trust me. Learn to trust me. And again, it's very much like a relationship in which, have you ever had a relationship in which someone says, you know, if you don't trust me, this relationship can't grow, right? If you keep questioning me or questioning my motives, this relationship can't grow. I've certainly been familiar with situations like that. And it, you know, that's the human condition, right? At a certain point for real intimacy, you have to trust each other. Well, to me, God isn't saying, obey me, obey me, obey me, obey me. I'm the great and mighty Oz. You know, you have to show that you're willing to take ridiculous leaps for me and go against your, you know, common sense. I don't see that that's what he's trying to do here at all. I think he keeps trying to say, I will provide for you.
I will take care of you. You are my children, but you've really got to learn to be intimate with me. You've really got to learn to trust me. So, and he's doing it in the most loving parentish way. Like, look, tell them I'm going to feed them. I'll feed them this at night. This is on the menu in the morning. They'll have dinner. They'll have breakfast, right? I mean, it's the most fundamental thing a parent does is feed a child, feed his family, right? Or her family. So God is just like, just tell them they'll get their breakfast. They'll get their dinner. They've just got to, you know, show, like they've got to grow in trust. That's all I ask. And these people just can't do it. They just have to whine. They have to control the situation. Again, it's understandable from their point of view. They're desperate and scared and in a completely new situation, and they're slaves, right? And I can't say enough, they're slaves. So they literally are just beginning to learn to think for themselves. But again and again, God is just saying, like, here's the manna. Here's the sweet water that I took, you know, that we miraculously brought from the bitter water. You've got everything you need. Just do it in this following way. And also God teaches them about the Sabbath. And you remember from Genesis, God created the earth in 6 days and then he rested. And again, this is such a, you know, beautiful example. I wrote an essay called Are We Like God? Do We Resemble God? Over and over, God has human-like qualities. And it doesn't, that doesn't mean he's brought down to our level. It means that we really are members of his family. You know, we're very similar, right? That's what I get from this Bible, this translation, and from the Hebrew. And one of the ways in which we're similar is God rests. You know, obviously, he's presumably all-powerful. He doesn't have to rest. But for whatever reason, he creates and rests. There's a rhythm of creation and rest, creation and rest. And that's a very human thing. If you've ever created something really beautiful that took your whole heart and soul, you know, there's a period afterwards where you let it out of the world and then you just kind of rest to fill up again. You know, who can understand that with God, right? But it's very relatable. And God is asking his creation to rest with him. All right. And so here God is trying to teach his people to rest with him on the Sabbath. And so he's saying, and Jews still do this, Orthodox Jews still do this. And I confess, as a, you know, conservative Jew and then a kind of secularish Jew, I really haven't taken the Shabbat too seriously, but I'm moved to try to take it more seriously from reading these passages, because God is really saying, look, okay, now I'll give you enough food for 2 days. You know, sunny Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, when you gather extra, it miraculously stinks and is full of maggots, right? So I'm just teaching you, trust me, don't gather extra. But Friday, you can gather enough for 2 days and then cook for Friday and Saturday, but don't cook on Saturday. You'll have enough to eat on Saturday. It's a day of rest. Well, Jews still do that. Like literally Orthodox Jews still do that. They will spend all day Friday, the women of the household, cooking, right? And then you don't, lo ta'asu kol melacha is what it is in Hebrew. Don't do all creation, all work. Melacha means creation, but it also means work. And that means don't turn on lights, don't light stoves, don't, you know, certainly don't go on the computer, don't work, you know, the kind of work you do during the week. But also there are literally in the shtetl, there used to be literally cookshops that kept the fires going into Saturday so that the housewives would bring their cholent or their casseroles or whatever. Cholent is kind of an Eastern European dish with stuff, intestines, which sounds disgusting, but it was a great delicacy for poor people in Eastern Europe. And they would drop it off on Friday, pick it up on Saturday. So not having lit a flame themselves, they could bring hot food home to their families. I guess what I'm saying is to this day, Orthodox Jews obey the directions. I prefer that to like, I think that's what we're getting here is guidance rather than something as rigid as these are my laws. Like if you don't obey my laws, I'll wipe you out. It's not like that. It's like here,
it's just really the metaphor I gave of like teaching a teenager to drive. Here's a car, here are the keys, you know, stop at the red lights, right? So you don't kill yourself. But it's, they're getting very loving, gentle guidance, as well as food and water in the desert. Here's how you rest with me. I'm going to rest on Saturday. You rest with me, please. And they just are having a hard time trusting that and doing it. But eventually they will get closer to that. But right here in this chapter, what we have is this very beautiful kind of foreshadowing that this generation, this enslaved generation, now free, are going to eat this miraculously produced food, manna, and drink this miraculously produced sweet water for 40 years. And that's where it ends. So, like, literally, God's care for looking after his children in the wilderness is going to continue for four more decades. They are going to eat their fill for four more decades from this point in the story where they're just kind of waking up as free men and women in the middle of a desert. And so that is the end of my talk to you about chapters Exodus 14 and 15 and 16. And I'm not going to read the Chabad version. I'll do that in our next discussion because of my technical challenges of reading and having the camera on at the same time. But I want to tell you a little bit more about what's going to be on the Passover plate. There's also going to be an egg, which symbolizes spring and rebirth. There's going to be a charoset, which is usually, there are many wonderful recipes for charoset, but it's usually apples and nuts and honey kind of mushed together with spices. There can be Ashkenazi versions, there can be Sephardic versions, there could be, you know, silver palette cookbook versions, right? Everyone's got a recipe for charoset. But it emerges as the same texture as mortar. And we create it and put it on the Passover dish to remember that we were slaves in Egypt and that we did hard labor. And it was building, you know, putting bricks on bricks on bricks and holding them together with mortar. And so instead of bitter mortar, it's sweet. And there's also maror, which is horseradish, or as my husband said this morning, radish. And I'm like, honey, horseradish. But that's what you get with a mixed marriage, the best of both kind of cultures informing each other. And so horseradish is, some is, you know, bright red. I'm sure you've seen that. Some is grated, kind of pale yellow horseradish, but it's bitter and tart, very strong. It can bring tears to your eyes. Why do we have maror, which again, remember they stopped at a place called Mara for the water, which was bitter, and mar means bitter. Maror means bitter, bitter herbs. We have that to remember how bitter slavery was. And, you know, it's supposed to bring tears to your eyes. And then there's this beautiful moment in the Passover Seder where you make a kind of, you take a piece of matzah, which I'll explain in just a minute, and you put a little bit of charoset, the sweet mortar memory, and maror, the horseradish, the bitter herb, on it at the same time, because you remember that that time was bitter, but it kind of carried within it the sweetness of this relationship with God, or being liberated by God, brought out of our condition of servitude by this set of miracles and this mighty hand, you know, the metaphor we keep going back to. What else? We have green herbs, again, symbolizing springtime. There's usually a bowl of salt water, which symbolizes the tears that the slaves shed, and matzah. And in fact, there's some very sacred matzah, if you can get it, made under very strict conditions. And that's called matzah shmura, which means like carefully guarded matzah. But even the ordinary matzah has a very special meaning, because you remember a few chapters back The children of Israel were told, okay, you're going to, you know, flee from Egypt. You're going to be running away. And if you've got bread that you're letting rise, basically, that's what leaven is. It's the rising agent. It's like yeast, right? If you've got yeasted bread, and you know, if you've ever baked yeasted bread, you have to let it rise. You have to leave it alone under a, you know, a cloth napkin, in a bowl for really a few hours, right? And then you punch it down and then you knead it. Well, there was no time for any of that. And so the children of Israel running away from the Egyptians, pardon me, they had to bake their bread, you know, without letting it rise. And so that's what matzah is. It's flat. If you've ever had matzah, it's like a cracker. It has no yeast in it. It's not yeasted. It's the kind of bread that you would get if you were literally baking your dough with no yeast on a rock in the sun while you were preparing to run away from an army. So that's where matzah comes from. And that's why it looks the way it does. And so Orthodox Jews, as I may have mentioned, are spending today very beautifully going through their houses with a candle and a feather to, and this is dates back from the, you know, 18th century, 17th century, 16th century, 15th century in Europe, rabbinical Judaism, the women of the household. And so many of the important things you do for to prepare for a holiday are done by the women of the household. It's a very important role to be a mom, a Jewish mother, preparing for a holy day. But they would use the candle to look in the corners of the pantry and make sure there was no chametz, which is yeast, leaven, right? Like no biscuits, no donuts, no bread. And you get it all out of your house before sundown tonight. And then for the next 7 days, you will just have matzah. And the other beautiful things I'll tell you about the Passover Seder, and I wish I could invite you all. You're all invited, by the way. So like Seders are supposed to invite everyone. Like, as I keep saying, non-Jews and Jews, they're supposed to invite their non-Jewish friends and neighbors. And very often when you go to a Seder, there'll be a bunch of Jewish people and then, you know, non-Jewish people who've been invited, because that's part of the important thing you're doing during the Seder, is welcoming everyone into this story. Well, you could go to Chabad if you want tonight and join the Seder, whoever you are. They're so welcoming. But it's also like, it's such a beautiful, important story, because it's basically saying, you know, we were all slaves. We've all been slaves, you know, whether it was literally enslaved in Egypt or enslaved, kidnapped in West Africa and brought to this country in a state of, you know, enslavement, enslaved in this country for 400 years, you know, whether we're, you know, physically trafficked, whatever it is, we all know what it's like to be in a state of servitude, to not be free. And I think the beauty of this Passover story, and why I think it's for everyone, and clearly God said it was for everyone, right, is that the basic kind of social contract, or the basic task of God's relationship to humans, I'm not going to say religion, because at this point I'll just say it, I don't think religion is the answer, right? I think a relationship with God is what these books are about. Not, I think religion is secondary, all right? Don't get mad at me. But I'm not saying it's not important, but it's not as important in the Old Testament or the New Testament as a relationship with God and with one's fellow human being. But it's the fundamental social contract is, are you going to be free, right? Because you can't really have a relationship with God if you're not in a state of free will. And so the very first question for anyone, I believe, and this is why, you know, you may have noticed I care a lot about freedom, right, in other contexts, in order to do anything in relation to God or in relation to one's fellow human being in alignment with God's will, you have to be in a state of freedom, right? You can't do it if you're enslaved. And that means enslaved to technology, enslaved to status, enslaved to money, enslaved to building a more fabulous addition to your house than your neighbor's addition, enslaved to alcohol or drugs, enslaved to people's approval. I mean, there are so many ways that we are enslaved. And, you know, we haven't talked about the adversary or Satan or, you know, the ways in which the adversary is going to be described in the Old Testament and the New Testament. But enslaving humans is the modus operandi. Why? Because when you're enslaved, you can't be in relationship with God or your fellow human beings in a way that's aligned with God's will for you. So freedom is number one, right? If you're going to be on this journey. And so in the Passover Seder, it's the story of how we came out of slavery into freedom through this miraculous set of interventions. But also it's a very deep discussion about the nature of freedom. And it includes a focus on the kids. And so at a certain point tonight, the youngest person present will be asked to pose the four questions. And these are like very ancient questions. What distinguishes this night from all other nights? And there are four different answers to that. And it's a very big deal when you're old enough, you know, 7 or 8 years old, to ask the four questions. And otherwise, there's going to be, you know, excerpts from Exodus and commentary from rabbis. But it's really, you know, the centerpiece of the Seder tonight is the older people telling the younger, we were slaves in Egypt, and this is what God did for me. You're supposed to think of yourself as being among the people that was liberated from Egypt. So it really brings the past very much to the present. So I'll just end there and say, you know, I don't think this is just a Jewish thing at all. We were all slaves in Egypt, right? And I think God is trying to get all of us out of slavery with a mighty hand. But there are things that we can do to help him. And so to me, humbly, that is the message of, or that's a takeaway from this incredible story of people in a state of servitude, coming into freedom, being disoriented, scared, freaked out, but slowly, slowly learning to have a relationship with their dad, basically, who is trying to help them get to a place where they can be free and choose, hopefully, a relationship with him that is aligned with him. All right, so let's just take a few questions here. Jeet Sabag says, wishing a happy Passover to all our friends. And I don't quite understand the rest of that comment. Someone is calling me a murderer, which is unfortunate. Let's see what other comments there are. Mark McLeod says, excellent that thought about slaves having to learn freedom. Had not thought of that. So interesting, right? And I hadn't either until I read it this time around. I mean, not very deeply. And thank you. Hopesicle Sabin says, thank you for showing Yahweh to me so beautifully. Thank you for participating in this conversation with me. There's a lot of strange trolling, which is odd because I would not have thought this is the kind of thing that would attract trolling. And I think that we will stop there. Chag Sameach, as they say, which means Chag is a holiday, Sameach is happy. And I hope you have a wonderful, whatever you're doing tonight. I hope you go to a Passover Seder if you can. Just ask a Jewish friend, see if you can join them, or go to Chabad if you can, if it's not too late to get a seat. If not, maybe you'll read a little more about Exodus. Either way, I hope, you know, you'll be with us in spirit. I'll bring you with me in spirit tonight. And thank you for letting me share a little bit about this fascinating situation where we reached Exodus. We reached the first Passover on the night of the first Passover. Is that special? I think that's kind of special. But to me, it's also just amazing how the human story is, it just evolves, right? It's, we learn and learn and learn, and the past, what did Faulkner say? The past is never gone. It's just past. Some version of that. The past is very much with us tonight. All right. Thank you all so much. If you want to support me and this reading, go to Outspoken and become a member. or a donor. If you want to support our work at Daily Clout, which is all about freedom, go to dailyclout.io, become a donor or a member. And I want to thank you all and have a wonderful night. Thanks for joining me. Bye-bye.